The easy part of doing early Mormon history is you just have a few locations. New York, Ohio, Missouri, and Nauvoo. That's it. No Mormons were anywhere else in the world during those years. Now, honestly, you can be forgiven for thinking that based on what traditionally has been published. And frankly, we have been a little guilty of that ourselves. Yeah, we showed you there's a little bit of Mormons outside in the British Mission era stuff, but we are a little light outside of the headquarters sites. It's time for an atonement. No, not the blood kind, just the regular podcasting kind of stuff. Hi, this is Lindsay Hanson Park.
And this is Brian Buchanan.
Bringing you the story of Mormonism from the shadow of the everlasting hills, straight out of Zion. This isn't your grandpa's Mormon history.
Well, I have sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
This is the tale of Mormon saints and sinners, from our roots until present day. Saddle up.
Gird your loins, lock your hearts, and pay your tithing, because we're bringing you the story of Mormonism in all its paradisiacal glory.
It's the Sunstone History Podcast.
Well, I've sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I've sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. But only you can save me, Brother Young.
Today, we're going to talk about the only place to rival Nauvoo on the crazy scale, Boston. We will take the high road and not go for low-hanging fruit like Boston's a great place to park your car and fruit of that nature. We're not going to do that. We're going to steer clear. Since Boston played such a key role in the larger American story, it seems only fitting that Mormonism was impacted there too. Because this is a proper Mormon story, it all begins with a revelation, of course. At a conference in Ohio, January 1832, Joseph Smith dictated a revelation that called a few dudes on missions. Among them were Orson Hyde and Samuel Smith, who were told to, quote, take their journey to the eastern countries. Interestingly, a newspaper report on this mission includes the first hint that Orson Hyde would go to Jerusalem. He would have to hold that thought for a decade, however. Within a week of that revelation, the Orson and Sam show departed for the East, slowly making their way through cities, visiting members, baptizing as they went. The pair finally made it to Boston by late June. Just a few days after rolling into town, they were Duncan folks in the baptismal waters. The question of who was the first baptized there is a bit of a trick question, because the first to be baptized in Boston were the Badlams, Alexander and Mary. However, the first resident of Boston to join with the Mormons was actually Vianna Jaques. Remember a billion years ago when we talked about her? She was baptized on a trip to Kirtland, which is completely cheating the system, Vianna.
The missionaries only spent a month or so in Boston, but gathered together a group of about 25 to 30 in that time. Mary Badlam was a fairly quiet person, but her brother Sam Brannan will make some serious noise here soon in this episode. And later on. Now, what's so fascinating about the Boston group is that the women here were very powerful, maybe more so than in any early Mormon site. First, you have Augusta Adams Cobb, who apparently was quite the forceful personality and would eventually really give Brigham Young the business as a plural wife. And we mean the business. You have Agnes Coolbrith, who would marry Joseph Smith. Her daughter, Josephina, real sly, she was usually just called Ina, would later become a famous poet in California. You also have Polly Vose, who was part of a very successful furniture industry. These Chippendale ladies would contribute a whole lot of cash to the very needy dudes in Kirtland. Quite the haul for any missionary duo.
My mother's helper, she had herself a baby. Didn't mean to drown it in the bath.
Like most small Mormon groups outside of the easy reach of headquarters, either in Ohio or Missouri, the Bostonians were just kind of left to play their own Mormon song for a while. Periodically, missionaries or church leaders would wander in and see what was good. One intriguing hint later in 1832 notes that the missionaries had to settle, quote, some difficulty among the sisters. Come on, guys, can you give us just a little taste of what was going on? Nothing. No hints. Over the next few years, Joseph Smith and Brigham Young would pass through a few times. We don't know a lot about these trips, but we do get a sense that Brigham was checking out Augusta Adams Cobb. She was a bit of a society matron and amazingly thought that he had at least some game. So Lindsay can stick that in her ear.
Somewhere there's a journal that describes how Brigham used hypnotism or mesmerism or some other of nonsensism to trick Augusta, because there's literally no other explanation. Oddly, it wasn't until 1842 that a branch was officially organized in Boston. Over the next 3 years, they would go through five branch presidents. The last of these five presidents is very interesting. Hold that thought for a minute, however, because we have to introduce you to the original Bash Brothers.
Ooh, wicked walk alone. Ooh, into damnation.
Yes, long before Jose Canseco and Mark McGuire, you had William Smith and Sam Brannan serving up shenanigans on the Eastern Seaboard. Just one of these two would probably have been enough rascal for the area, but the two of them fed off each other. One of the most problematic symbiotic relationships of the era.
You may remember a few odds and ends about little brother William Smith, but let's just take a sec, pull those threads together for a minute. Honestly, with old Willie, the best I can say for him is that he was tall. Really, that's about it. Otherwise, lots of red flags. Violence? Oh, you bet. Couple quick vignettes. Early on, I mean really early on, a crew of townsfolk comes to put Joseph Sr. in debtor's prison. Lucy, the mom, later narrated the results, quote, William seized a large handspike, sprang upstairs, and in one instant cleared the scoundrels out of the chamber. They scampered downstairs, he flew after them, and bounding into the very midst of the crowd, he brandished his handspike in every direction, exclaiming, away from here, you cutthroats, instantly, or I will be the death of every one of you. Like Jim Croce told us, you don't mess around with Jim, or William, whatever. Second story. After a pretty ugly incident with Brother Joseph, and even their mother Lucy in public, William starts hosting a debate school at his house in Kirtland. A very vintage setting, I would argue. Joseph feels like it's way too likely that people are going to get hot under the collar and suggests they discontinue the idea. William tells him, bruh, my house, my rules, man. Not surprisingly, the other apostles, and remember, for the rest of all of this nonsense, William is an apostle. They side with Joseph, and during a council meeting to try and figure this out, William charges Joseph. Joseph is trying to get his coat off to fight. They're playing, tell me you're fighting in 1836 without telling me you're fighting in 1836. William beats the absolute crap out of his brother, even the prophet Joseph. One account said he felt the effects of that beating the rest of his life. So, yeah, there's some red flags with William.
Okay, I'm looking at the clock here, and we've got to get back to Boston. All right, William, time to leave Nauvoo. Oh, before you leave, though, let's get you married to a plural wife. What's that? She's only been off the boat from England for a month? No problem. Thrones, principalities, powers, yada yada. Oh, also, there were some pretty good rumors that William had been mixed up with John C. Bennett and the Merry Pranksters. Well, sure hope that doesn't carry over to Boston.
Said one, two, three, pass that old bottle down. It's high west when I'm dry. Three, four, five, hold me sweet, your little kisses, baby, and give me heaven when I die. It's burning hot now, wild and free, down the road to Lover's Lane. Those midnight lanterns shine, and burning oh so bright, and this may never be again.
On the way east, William and his slowly dying first wife, Caroline, who happens to be the sister of my eternal BFF, Jedediah Grant, old Jetty, they stop over in Philadelphia where one dude hasn't got the memo about the first rule of Polygamy Fight Club. Don't talk about Polygamy Fight Club, dummy. This sets up an odd situation where, probably for the first time, someone outside of Nauvoo has to deny that Mormons are doing the polygamy while simultaneously being, you know, an actual polygamist.
So, welcome to Boston, William, I guess. One can't dance the chaos tango without a partner, however. Let's talk about Sam Brannan now. He was born in Saco, Maine, home, of course, to the famous Cochranites. Fun fact, every time you say Saco, a polygamy denier gets their wings. As we mentioned earlier, his sister Marianne and her husband Alexander, the Badlums, were the first to be baptized in Boston. A year later, though, they all moved to Kirtland, where Sam went under the water himself. After a few years of traveling nearly everywhere in the U.S., as it looked at the time, I mean, he goes to New Orleans, for example, he joins his brother-in-law, Alexander Badlam, on a mission that brings him back to the East Coast. By the time that William and Sam join forces, it's early 1844, and the Joseph Smith for President campaign is heating up. And remind me, what was the campaign slogan?
Make Adam God Again?
No, that's later.
Tippecanoe and Sidney Rigdon too? A few months before her 15th birthday, or fight, don't change Kurlam's midstream.
Fine, it's not important.
Not close, nothing?
Part of the campaign strategy was to have newspapers outside of Nauvoo that could pitch Brother Joseph to a wider audience. The paper that William Smith and Sam Brannan were to publish was titled The Prophet. Yeah, I know, super subtle. And remember, these are not old, mature dudes we're talking about. William is in his early 1830s. Sam is only 25. I keep forgetting it's in the story. They're just little dudes still. William is in a very interesting stage of life. After tuning out Mormonism for a few years, remember, he's an apostle the whole time. One of the 12 is just like, just not really into Mormonism right now. I'm going to do my own thing.
Going to take a breather.
I'm on sabbatical. But by now, after Dad had died, it seems like he really kind of re-engaged. But it was on his terms. It was always on William's terms. Okay, time to get serious. Polygamy in old Boston town. It seems most likely that William teaches Brannan and another sketchy dude named George Adams about polygamy, and apparently also passes on authority to perform polygamous marriages. Not that that's going to create any problems or anything.
I'm back here with my good friend Ben Park, Professor Park, historian, author. What are you up to these days?
Parent seems to take a big time as well, but historian and author I will gladly call.
Yeah, you're going to be starting school next week in the middle of COVID.
You know, nothing like cramming inside an auditorium with 200 Texas freshmen that gets your spirit running.
I can't tell if I feel more sorry for you or kindergarten teachers, you know, with all the kids sneezing and feel bad for teachers. If you're a teacher out there, hang in there. So Ben, I am so glad we're going to talk about this because we've been talking to you about Nauvoo. Obviously, you've written the book on Nauvoo, but other things were going on in Mormonism during the Nauvoo period that we don't always talk about. So we want to talk about Boston. And I'm wondering if you can, first of all, explain what the Mormon community is like in Boston for us.
Yeah, it's such a fascinating topic because when we look at Mormon history, we always focus on the hubs of where most of the Mormons were living, like in Nauvoo. When in reality, during the 1840s, you have this explosion of Mormon communities throughout America and then eventually out in England of these scattered saints in communities trying to form their own congregations. And of course, many are going to migrate to Nauvoo or wherever the migration hub is at the time, but many also stay around. And in many ways, these are the communities that historians seem to spend more time on because I think they're not what we expect them to be. One term that some historians have used is the ungathered. And to give you an example, Boston is one of these largest communities. And Connell O'Donovan and several other historians have done wonderful work in reconstructing the Boston community. Christopher Allison wrote a great article in Journal of Mormon History a few years ago about this Boston community and give you a sense of what it's like. They're a majority female. They're a majority middle class. They meet in the house of one of the local congregants, and they're basically dying to have any priesthood leadership to come to preside at all because in general, they're mostly a group of very diligent and faithful Latter-day Saint women and a few men that they drag to the meetings, and then whatever a rotating cast of presiding elders coming through at various times. So as a result, you got this female dominant, eclectic leadership roulette, where I imagine the lived realities and experience of those Mormons in Boston is very different than what you find in Nauvoo. And as a result, when one group might find out about the other, you end up getting some conflicts and crises, which is what you see happen in the 1840s.
Well, that's what I want to dig into, because I, like you said, it was women dominated. These were powerful women. They were good at organizing and they were doing pretty great, but they had to deal with these different, as you called it, traveling elders. So give us a brief introduction of some of the main characters involved in these traveling elders, because I actually think some of these characters are the most understudied in our history.
Yeah, so these traveling elders are just fascinating because Mormonism is growing at such an extraordinary rate. And because Mormonism is also transforming so quickly during these years, you get a vacuum for leadership in these outlying communities that lots of ambitious and talented and often egotistical men are able to fill. Men like Samuel Brannan, and Joseph Ball. So Samuel Brannan and Joseph Ball, they convert to the church a few years before the 1840s, and they spend a lot of years as missionaries and going out and spreading the gospel. And when you put in your years of missionary work, you kind of earn your capital with Joseph Smith, and then you get leadership positions. So both of these men are placed in leadership positions in Ohio and Pennsylvania and New York, and then eventually they each take turns in Boston. And it's in Boston where they really dig in their roots and they find this vibrant spiritual community that they get to take over as the priesthood leaders, you know, setting aside the fact that it's the women in those communities that make those congregations flourish.
You know, what's interesting is, again, we're sort of centering on these elders, but as we mentioned in this podcast, some of these other women, Vienna, do you say it? Correct, Brian and I, is it Jax or Jacques?
You know, the French language training that I've had has me say Jacques, but I honestly have no idea how they would have pronounced it back then.
I'm gonna go with yours. I feel like 90% of me on this podcast is asking out loud, how do you say that?
Is it Valet or Valator? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about William Smith for a minute, because he's interesting. He's an apostle throughout, you know, a lot of this time, and he's kind of a wild card. Sometimes he takes a hiatus from Mormonism, sometimes he's back. What is your opinion on just his general relationship with Mormonism? Was it about family for him? Was it about faith?
Both. William Smith is just such a mercurial figure. That's my word of the day for him. He's the mercurial figure he has the same temper that Joseph Smith has. He probably has the big mood swings that Joseph Smith also had, but he also did not have the charisma that he could then gain, you know, the confidence and place himself back in the good graces of people to whom he had angered. So he was often on the, he would sometimes, you know, be on good terms with Joseph Smith, but more often he'd be on the outside. I mean, Joseph and William, they come to blows at one point in Kirtland, fighting each other. So there's no love lost there. I mean, it's a brotherhood rivalry that matches, I imagine, many listeners have experienced. And by Nauvoo, William Smith really is kind of on the outskirts. He's not sent to Britain, or he is supposed to go to Britain, but he doesn't go to Britain with the rest of the apostolic missionaries. So he kind of loses the fraternity and the relationship that many of the apostles and other leaders have. And by, you know, the time of Joseph Smith's death, William Smith is around, but he's not really in the inner circle anymore. And he knows it, and he's pretty upset about that.
I think that's a really good insight, because when I think about this period, I try to think, like, how did he come up with those ideas? I mean, he's Joseph Smith's brother. You'd think that he would know. He obviously trades off his name in Mormon communities about being a Smith, but he also tries to be Joseph Smith in some ways. In Boston, he gives people authority to practice plural marriages, which he argues is his right to do so, but other elders say no. So How do you think he comes up with this idea that he can decide who can perform plural marriages?
You know, I had a great experience when I was writing my book on Nauvoo that sheds light on this, that when I was writing about John C. Bennett, and I had a passage in my chapter about talking about John C. Bennett's illicit activities in Nauvoo, and I said that John C. Bennett was taking these religious ideas of companionship and molding it to fit his, you know, his illicit lifestyle. And my editor, who is not a Mormon and is not as familiar with the Mormon tradition, he writes in the margins while he was doing edits and goes, how does this make him different than Joseph Smith? And it made me actually take a step back and think about how we frame these figures. And so with William Smith, it's very easy from an LDS perspective to say that he is going off on his own and, you know, ordaining people to practice plural marriage and practicing plural marriage himself to satiate his own desires. When in reality, that's too much of a black and white dichotomy. That if you look at the practices of Joseph Smith slowly, or not so slowly at some points, spreading polygamy in Nauvoo, almost no one has a full information of what's going on. Brigham Young only gets bits and pieces. John C. Bennett only gets bits and pieces. William Clayton only gets bits and pieces. So I imagine William Smith is only getting bits and pieces of polygamy as well. And all of them are trying to do what they believe is, one, what's revealed, and two, is fulfilling what they believe are their natural proclivities or privileges or inclinations. And so while it's very easy to cast William Smith as this renegade, you know, teaching polygamy where he's not supposed to, you can almost take it as what makes his activities any more illicit than what Hiram Smith starts doing when he starts teaching polygamy in Nauvoo shortly after he's introduced to pieces of it. So what we get in Mormonism, and especially in 1840s Mormonism, is this crisis of authority, of not knowing who is actually has the capital to spread these teachings and to be in charge of these new controversial unions. William Smith probably genuinely believed that by virtue of being in the Smith family, by virtue of being an apostle, he's able to do the same things that Joseph Smith is doing. And since he's not within the inner circle of the apostles who's in charge of Nauvoo, he's able to do it in his own vineyard, which is Boston.
And isn't it Mike Quinn who pointed out that, you know, the post-manifesto history it mimics sort of this early polygamy history. It's the same thing after the manifesto is done or during the Mormon underground, right? Who has the authority to perform these marriages? Whose marriages are valid? Which ones are adultery? Which ones are not? I mean, it's always been a messy practice.
In looking at these practices and guessing who has authority, we often look at it in presentist terms to where we live in 21st century Mormonism, and everything's top down, everything's synthesized, everything operates as a hierarchical denomination. That hasn't always been the case. Like with the post-manifesto marriages, the thing that stood out to me is the debate over post-manifesto marriages in the first decade of the 20th century was a debate over denominational control, right? It wasn't always the case that your bishop was in complete control over your religious life. And so that those who were continuing on their polygamy, they're like, no, my primary devotion is to the principle. Whereas, no, the church is now evolving into a denomination, so your primary allegiance should be to the priesthood leadership. And that's a conflict that goes back all the way to the beginning.
I love that. I think that's perfectly said and gives people a better context for what's going on. And I like what you said about it being illicit. I do think it's true that it is judged differently than Joseph Smith because of the way that Mormons look at it, the organizational structure from a modern lens. So we know that Woodruff complains about Samuel Brannan and William Smith teaching the, quote, kissing spiritual wife doctrine. Can you talk to us about the polygamy in Boston? What are examples of what they were doing and why it was causing so many problems?
Well, the difficult answer to that difficult question is that we don't fully know what was going on, because like what was going on in Nauvoo with John C. Bennett and others, there are these competing agendas going on. On the one hand, they want to root out unauthorized activity. priests to reaffirm priesthood control, especially after Joe Smith dies in 1844 and Wilford Woodruff and other apostles are trying to reaffirm their authority as the apostolic successors of Joseph Smith, you know, and as William Smith is further alienated and people like Samuel Brannan and Joseph Ball are seen as threats, they need to, on the one hand, show that what they were doing was not authorized. But on the other hand, we don't want details to get out because we don't want the general public to know that we're practicing polygamy. So we have to control the illicit authority. It's almost like the primary fear of the church leaders is the control issue, not the affairs issue and not the relationships issue. And so what Samuel Brannan and William Smith and Joseph Ball were doing, we're not quite sure. There might have been, you know, some consummation of spiritual unions. There might have been some flirtation, the kissing spiritual wife doctrine. I tell you, when I see that phrase, you know, bandied about in their disciplinary councils, I see it as a catchphrase to just group them with John C. Bennett, right? To say that what they're doing is just another example of what John C. Bennett did a couple of years ago. So the reality is we're not quite sure because in fact, we don't have a lot of records from those faithful LDS women in those in the Boston area. In Nauvoo, during the John C. Bennett trials, we have several Latter-day Saint women who come forward and talk about what happened. Whereas in Boston, I think because it's not an area that they can control the media, because it's in Boston, and because they have this national crisis over these new apostles who are taking over, I think they do all they can to keep the crisis squelched and sequestered. And as a result, we just don't have much details of what was going on beyond the fact that William Smith was exerting authority to authorize other men to both preside over and enter into polygamous marriages.
We're probably going to do an episode of Before They're Famous on Sam Brannan and Joseph T. Ball, because Joseph T. Ball's really, really interesting story. Sam Brannan too, but Sam Brannan is kind of an enigma to me in Boston. When you look at the arc of his life and where it goes, I can't tell if he's really into Mormonism or he just is on the fringes of Mormonism at the time. Where do you place Sam Brannan?
It's a great question. I don't know Sam Brannan as much as I'd like. I mean, I'd like to take him out to drink and figure out what really drives him. But I think that question of what's really driving them is a question that you'd have for a lot of these presiding traveling elders during this time, because they're operating in a Mormon system that we're not familiar with. As presiding in the ungathered communities, who's really in charge? Robin Jensen, who's an editor with the Joseph Smith Papers Project, and I have always bandied about this idea of a project on the succession crisis. And one of the things that stands out to us is that these communities like Boston, who have only experienced people like Sam Brannan and Joseph Ball and William Smith, they experience a succession crisis very different than those in Nauvoo, because they don't see the church as something that's centered on, you know, one presiding authority of who's going to replace Joseph Smith. In fact, when James Strang becomes the leader of the Strangite movements and he starts getting a national attention, he starts getting letters from all these outlying communities like Boston, including from Joseph Ball, by the way, saying, hey, we keep hearing these words that we need to pledge our allegiance to Brigham Young and the Quorum of the Twelve, now based on Utah. We have no idea what that means. Our Mormonism is basically we gather here in Boston, we read the Book of Mormon, and we live our spiritual lives. What does it even mean that we have to choose which prophet is our leader? Which should give us an insight into how Mormonism operated outside of these centers. And I think Samuel and that type of setting enable people like Samuel Brannan and Joseph Ball to be able to flourish.
That's fascinating. I never thought of it that way, but I think you're absolutely right. And I think it probably gives some insight into where they end up in their lives, both of them. Is there anything in particular about Boston, other than secret spiritual wife kissing doctrine, that you find interesting or that you think more people should know about?
Yeah, I mean, the Boston Saints, I'm fascinated by the racial dynamics of that religious group. Joseph Ball, as some, maybe all of your listeners might know, he's often seen as the first African-American high priest, ordained to be a high priest in the LDS tradition. The complications there, though, is that he did not identify as As African-American, he identified as white. He passed as white during this time. We don't know what he saw himself as. We just know what he presented himself as and what other people saw him as. But that does not mean that there were not people who identified as African-American in the Boston congregation. You have Walker Lewis. You have Elijah Lovejoy Lewis. You have several different Black families who are affiliating with the church, some baptized, some ordained. And so you just get this Boston community that looks so different than everywhere else in the LDS tradition at the time, that is multiracial. It's multigendered in who's actually leading the communities. And so as a result, I think it's just a fascinating other story of how Mormonism could have operated when outside the view of, you know, those who were in charge.
Well, I really appreciate you taking your time out of your very busy, busy schedule right now to give us this interview. Thanks, Ben.
My pleasure. Always an honor.
In the hinterlands, news about the murder of Joseph and Hiram Smith was some time in reaching William. With Samuel's death just after that, William was the lone surviving Smith brother. Since Big Brother Joe had always run interference for William, the shiz was about to hit the fan. Wilford Woodruff stopped by on his way to England and found out that the shenanigans were afoot in Boston. In a letter back to Brigham and Nauvoo, Wilford reported that William Smith and others were apparently helping themselves to Nauvoo Temple donations. However, Woodruff, the tattletale, was much more concerned about what he called the kissing women spiritual wife doctrine, and that's in quotes, kissing women spiritual wife doctrine. If that doesn't make you happy just to hear that term, please talk to your bishop.
Finally, Wilford Woodruff and William Smith find themselves in the same room. The setting is a church meeting in Boston. Woodruff, who always seems to be a pretty straightforward dude, doesn't beat around the bush. He recorded this back and forth in his letter back to Brigham. I, Wilford, asked how Brother Brannan came to be marrying people for eternity. He says I appointed him to do it. Meaning, I think, that William is saying he authorized Brannan to perform the marriages. Woodruff objected. His administrations are not legal. Yes, they are. Any elder can do it that has power to marry at all. Woodruff replied, it is a right exclusively belonging to the Quorum of the Twelve or the President of the Quorum, not legal with those who are not endowed. Smith rebutted, that has reference to exclusive privileges. Second anointings? I couldn't quite tell what he's referring to, but not to sealing a man to his wife for eternity, for any elder can do that. Now, in all of the conversations between church leaders on the stand, I have to think this has got to be one of the spiciest.
If it's spicy you want, take mine. That joke will be funny to approximately four of you, and you four are very welcome. Yeah, things were going to get ugly up in Boston. William Smith, Sam Brannan, and George Adams, the unofficial troika back there, removed John Hardy as branch president and replaced him with Joseph T. Ball. Sorry to say hold that thought again, but hold that thought with Joseph Ball again. See, John Hardy wasn't the kind of guy you get sacked from a church position and thinks, sweet, I get my life back. No, ma'am. His reaction is more, hold up a second. This fancy unofficial local presidency here is eyeballs deep in polygamy. Please tell me you're guessing here that the guilty polygamous preaching threesome isn't going to be happy about these accusations. Good. Yeah, they fight back.
Okay, it's time for church court. The Honorable Will Smith presides over this court. I know, there's something wrong when a dude blows the whistle on polygamous hijinks and then gets put on trial himself. Welcome to Mormon polygamy. Blowing the whistle, not a great idea. During the trial, a man named George Wallace testifies that George Adams had been cohabiting with three Williams. W, asterisk, 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 W, da, 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 and B, asterisk, asterisk, asterisk. Notice all of those asterisks. If your memory is on its game tonight, you might remember that John C. Bennett did that same thing in History of the Saints. Honestly, the more stuff that comes out in this trial, it really does sound like just a transplant of Bennett-era craziness to Boston. Maybe even ratcheted up a notch. Friend of the podcast, Connell O'Donovan, whose research fueled a lot of this episode, hypothesizes that that last name, the B one, is Brannan's wife, and so we might have some wife swapping going on here.
Oh, man.
Swinging in Boston.
It was swinging times. George Adams is accused of actually marrying a plural wife named Sarah Clark. He was accused of taking her and a sister, into a private room where he swore them into the secrets of a lodge, which secrets were not to be revealed under the penalty of their lives, and then told them they knew more than the whole church in New Bedford. Just to keep up the drama, Mary Wallace, married to George Wallace from just a minute ago, apparently calls Adam's new plural wife a strumpet.
Zing!
It could get worse. This may be a good time to cover the ears of your avid 5-year-old Sunstone History podcast listener. John Hardy, still fighting for his position, testified that William Smith's stained sheets were sent to be washed in a most unutterable situation.
Ew.
Don't worry, though. William explained that he had the blood bile for several years. Good. For a minute there, I thought there might have been some serious swinging going on.
Oh, sorry, man. I got the blood bile again.
Blood bile? Really, William? Come on.
Gross. Okay, you can all quit being patient now. They succeed in replacing Hardy with Joseph T. Ball. Now, what do we know about him? Ball occupies a really interesting place in Mormon history. He is described by several historians as the first black Mormon to be ordained high priest and definitely the first one to preside over a branch. The story of the Ball family is a powerful and uncomfortable reminder of the struggles that black families encountered. Joseph's father, Joseph Ball Sr., was born in Jamaica, likely the child of enslaved parents. Connell O'Donovan suggests his family was actually associated with British royalty. Unfortunately, we don't know a lot about his mother, Mary Drew, but it appears that she was white. So on both the 1810 and 1820 census, the Ball family is described as free colored persons. However, in 1830, they're now listed as white, and would be so for the rest of their lives. Family members were involved in abolitionist causes. They were even mentioned by William Lloyd Garrison, so they were well connected.
Now we get to a far trickier question. Did fellow Mormons in the Boston area think of the Balls as black or white? The biography of Joseph Ball in the Century of Black Mormons database, which is excellent, written by the Joseph Smith Papers guy Jeff Mahas, notes that one study of the Ball sisters, Martha and Lucy, found no evidence that anyone who knew them in the abolition movement referred to their race in letters or other writings. Similarly, Jeff concludes that, quote, there is no evidence that any of Ball's associates and co-religionists in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints ever saw him as anything other than white, end quote. But on the other hand, Connell O'Donovan found that Martha was, quote, described by a fellow abolitionist as being slightly colored. And sometimes the sisters appear as, quote, black delegates at various conferences. He argues that family members didn't really begin attempting to pass as white until about 1840. Nailing down the date of Joseph's baptism is tough. The Century of Black Mormons opts for circa 1832, as does Connell O'Donovan in one place. In another, he instead suggests maybe 1836. Both dates, however, are long before it seems like the family was passing for white. In the end, it's difficult to assess how much Joseph Ball's racial background played into his Mormonism. What does seem clear was that Ball was accused of being cut from the same cloth as Sam and William. So he probably fit in great in Boston. He was part of that group that told women in Lowell, which is a town near Boston, that it was, quote, not wrong to have intercourse with the men, what they please, and Elder Ball tries to sleep with them when he can, end quote.
That is a Babes in Toyland line if I ever heard one.
We stood on the cliffs on a starless night. I held your hand in mine. So stand by me.
Now, the whole time we've been talking about Ball, William Smith has been impatiently raising his hand like Horshack and Welcome Back Cotter. He wasn't done with crazy, oh no. He was entangled in a pretty ugly legal battle with Benjamin Winchester, a fairly important Mormon at the time, but basically totally unknown today. Willie had accused Winchester of being involved in the murders of his brothers, Joseph and Hiram. I'd say that's a serious accusation. Sam Brannan, of course, had gotten involved, and so Winchester threw his name on the charges. Woodruff, passing through, is aware of all this crap as well, and strongly suggests to Brigham back in Nauvoo that maybe they could replace the Bash brothers with folks who weren't, you know, maniacs, maybe? As a result, Parley Pratt shows up in the East to take over the operations. I know, you're thinking, wait, we're sending Steely McWife as a less inflammatory option? Calm down, that's the next decade, we'll get there.
Despite all the madness and allegations, it seemed that Sam Brannan would just sail on through as calm as a summer's morn. Back in old Nauvoo, however, Sammy had managed to cross some undefined lines and gotten himself excommunicated in absentia. Just for good measure, Brigham published a notice about the East Coast Yahoos. Quote, their conduct has been such as to disgrace them in the eyes of justice and virtue, and we cannot and will not sanction men who are guilty of such things, as we have every reason to believe that they have from the most indubitable testimony, we have for some time been unwilling to believe the foul statements concerning them, but the nature of the testimony now adduced compels us to believe that the statements are but too true, and that under the sacred garb of religion they have been practicing the most disgraceful and diabolical conduct.
Man, those pearls are just getting clutched all to death there.
Bring me the smelling salts. Oh, Briggy. Give it 2 years and your widely publicized adultery case with Augusta Adams Cobb will make this look like the headline in the Podunkville Messenger. Don't worry, William hustled his apostolic butt back to headquarters and went to bat for Brannan. Sam was reinstated without even having to appear before the 12. Since Garth was in town, the day this was written, remember, Sam's got friends in apostolic places.
Amazingly, Sam seemed to be untouchable at this time. He soon joined William in Nauvoo and finally had to face the music with the apostles. And you remember George Wallace from a little bit earlier? He tells the apostolic court that Brannan had basically assaulted his sister Sarah. Again, don't fret here because William then apparently sealed them. This woman, already traumatized, was worried that she now belonged to Brannan for time, if not for eternity also. Congratulations, you were assaulted. Now you get to be sealed to him.
Ugh.
Yuck. Parley Pratt tried to explain that this sealing was complete nonsense. Who knows how helpful that was to her? The poor woman died 2 months later from, you guessed it, consumption. The descriptions of the ravages of tuberculosis, not pleasant. Add the trauma from the disaster with Sam Brannan, that had to have been a terrible ending to her life.
Here's the thing. Ben Park complained about all the poop talk with the cholera. We are deliberately not going into the TB symptoms to protect your virgin ears.
Do you see that high road up there? We're taking it.
Hey, look, there it is. There's tuberculosis down below in the river of mud.
Mm-hmm.
Are you mad yet? Hang on just a sec, because Brigham, as was frequently his MO, would make it worse. At the conclusion of the meeting, he declared that, quote, since Sister Wallace has gone home, we could throw the mantle over the whole and shutter the subject. It's basically saying she's dead, get over it. When he sat down to write Parley Pratt about the whole episode, he reported, quote, we did not find matters in relation to Brother Brannan's conduct so bad as had been reported. The difficulty between him and Brother Wallace was satisfactorily adjusted, and inasmuch as the principal accuser is now dead, and we have concluded to let it rest and have restored Brother Brannan to full fellowship and confidence. Ugh. Amazingly, after this chapter of Boston Mormon history, things actually calmed down. Dramatically. I mean, it didn't hurt that Sam Brannan, George Adams, William Smith, and Joseph Ball all left for Nauvoo around the same time. All the shenanigans went with them. The next generation of local leaders don't seem to have been interested in preaching the kissing women spiritual wife doctrine. And honestly, the Mormons in Boston were more than happy to see it go. There is plenty more fascinating twists and turns in Boston. Hopefully, though, this gives you a sense for how chaotic things were at the same time that Nauvoo was imploding. We're not quite done with the city, however. We'll come back fairly soon to talk more about some other Black Mormons there. The city was perhaps as influential in the genesis of the priesthood and temple ban as anything else.
Trust me now, believe in me, forevermore you love, you have clutched to
me. Hey, psst, keep it down over there. It's time for the Books of Mormon report. For the Bash Brothers, we recommend first Scoundrel's Tale, a fascinating documentary history of Sam Brann, edited by a friend of the podcast, Will Bagley. If you can believe it, the rest of Sam's life was maybe even crazier than the stuff today. and for his colleague, Kyle Walker's biography, William B. Smith. Later in life, he was in, during the Civil War, there was a guy in his regiment that was also William Smith, who was like, no, I'm different. I'm unique. I'm now William B. Smith. Really weird. William B. Smith in the Shadow of a Prophet. Very good book also. Now finally, in talking about Boston and Mormonism, Connell O'Donovan's fantastic material on his easy-to-remember website, www.connellodonovan.com, is indispensable. We've talked about Connell's work several times before. It's excellent. He has these massive PDFs that have short bios on the early Boston Mormons as well as folks in nearby Lowell that we mentioned. At some point, Connell's stuff on Boston needs to be published. It's so important.
It's so good. Go look it up and read it. You are in for some juicy, juicy rabbit holes. And by the way, juicy rabbit holes is something I promise to never say in the podcast again.
Offering for my sins, a smoking incense, Brother Young, a blood atoning for my sinning, Brother Young. 'Cause I sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young. Let only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young.
But only the song you heard today is called Brother Brigham, Brother Young by an artist, Corb Lund. Check out his music at corblund.com. And consider giving a donation to sunstone.org to support this podcast.